Welcome in, everybody, to the best in paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Tim Dennis. Got a good show today, and it is quite complex, so I'm going to have you put on your thinking caps. We're going to delve a little deep into history. Some people might say alternative history, but our guest has found a way to knit it all together and make it history. I know that sounds confusing. We'll get to it in a moment as we're going to explore the empires of Atlantis. I want to clarify something from yesterday's Supernatural News program. I've had quite a few people get a hold of me by email and say, Tim, what is that tincture that you're taking to lower your inflammation markers and your sedentary markers in your blood? The tincture I'm taking is called Lacticarum, is what it's called, Lacticarum. You get it at wildlettuce.com, and it's just real easy. Again, I'm not being compensated for this. I'm not receiving any compensation whatsoever for it. Lacticarum. You can either get it with an alcohol base or a glycerin base. You get it at wildlettuce.com. It's not just any ordinary lacticarum that you would order, like, say, through Amazon or whatever. The people at wildlettuce.com actually use the best of the best ingredients, and that's why it works. And like I said, I've lowered my CRP inflammation number from a 12.4 out of 8, out of an 8 scale, to a 5.9 out of 8. So it's gone to normal in just a matter of weeks, but I've been taking it twice a day out of that. It's recommended you take 5 to 7 drops to start with and take it once a day. I've been taking it twice a day and getting a result. So I know quite a few of you went out and went and ordered it yesterday as a result. And happy to see that you guys are trying it, which is good. Again, results may vary. It's not sanctioned by the FDA or anything like that. You'll see that on the website. It's listed as a food additive. But it worked for me. I've got medical results, and I'll be glad to show you if you want to see it. That's the only thing that's changed in my medical regimen. So there you go. Let's get on with the show, shall we? Our guest is quite the exciting one. I've been reading this book and diving into this book. It's called The Empires of Atlantis, The Origins of Ancient Civilizations and Mystery Traditions Throughout the Ages. And boy, I'll tell you, this is a read that definitely gets you to screw on your thinking cap and really dive in. Let's bring in our guest now, Marco Vigato. Marco, how are you?
Good, Tim, and thank you so much for having me on the show.
Well, thank you for being with us. We'll start as to why it's quite the thinker when we get into it here. When I first crack open the book, and the first thing that hits me in the face is we're talking about ancient civilizations, not just Atlantis to start with. We're starting with ancient civilizations from all over the globe. We're talking about we're talking about civilizations in the BCE era. Mm-hmm. And you're taking these ancient civilizations and you're, for a very good reason, you're matching them up with each other to show that time is not as we know it and time mm-hmm. is not as we measure it. I think we're so used to how we measure time right now, according to the Gregorian calendar, it is the Gregorian calendar we measure by, right? Or is it the Julian calendar? I get those two mixed up.
it's Gregorian.
Okay, Gregorian yes. calendar, sorry. And that we measure everything in, okay, so, you know, a couple thousand years ago, Christ is born, and then... We've only been on this earth, if you believe in Christian beliefs, we've only been on this earth so many thousands of years, and then that's it. But you really open up the doors right in the first 50 pages of the book and get people thinking in hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years. And mm-hmm. you start to compare civilizations, pyramids of Giza and Egypt, and start talking about hundreds of thousands of years and the reigns of kings that go tens of thousands of years. And you go, wait a minute, how is it that the earth is 900, you know, 900,000, no, it's 900 million years old, isn't there? Something like that, according to the...
Well, a bit more than that. I think it's more like 4, 4.5 billion, according to the latest science.
Okay, so, but then that blows, somebody who sits from a theological frame of mind, explain to them how that is and how that converts down in a mathematical equation to what we know from a Christianic equation, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, no, and I think, Tim, you touched on a number of really important subjects. So, first of all, the book is truly an inquiry into the origins of civilization, and that's the reason why it goes back so far in time, trying to really understand or answer some of the fundamental questions about human origins and the origins of civilization. Now, when you think about the different concepts of time, we're very used to a concept of linear time, which is or has been the prevalent view in science, but also in religion, in Christianity, in Judaism for the past 2,000 years. However, when you look at the traditional cosmologies, and we're talking about the Sumerians, Babylonians, Egyptians, the ancient Greeks, so very ancient civilization, we're talking about BCE eras, they had a different concept of time. It was a concept of cyclical time that we have largely forgotten. So that's the reason why, if we think just in terms of the biblical chronology or even the modern evolutionary theory, what you have is almost a linear progression of mankind. If you're a believer, that would be a linear progression from the time of creation towards salvation, which is, by the way, not so different from the view of mainstream science, which believes in these almost constant universal progression, this process of evolution, in which you go from simpler organisms or civilizations towards the more complex. And again, this is a view which has developed, has truly become mainstream over the past few centuries. But before that, for thousands of years, ancient civilizations were based on a concept of cyclical time. You have entire cosmologies that were built on this concept of cyclical time. And basically, what that means is that rather than having just a single linear progression of humanity and civilization, you have multiple cycles of creation in which a golden age gives way to a silver age, a bronze age, an iron age. So there is a process of decadence, and then the cycle starts again with another golden age. And this cycle repeats itself over and over again many, many times, as it has already repeated itself over the course of human history. And that's where you start finding some of these very large numbers that you mentioned in ancient cosmologies. You have cycles of tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of years. And if you believe some of these cosmologies, we just live in the last of many cycles of creation, of many different cycles of civilization that took probably the good part of the last 500,000 years.
And there's many examples in the book, even in this, in the first 50 to 75 pages, of these different golden age, silver age, bronze ages, and how they cross over different civilizations in different parts of the world, which make me wonder, when we start talking about that, if they're even aware of each other at the same time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's the really interesting thing to me, because it's not just finding similar myths around the world. And of course, you can argue that all these different civilizations could have come up with similar mythology, similar cosmology, quite independently from each other. But then how do you explain the fact, for instance, that all these cosmologies, they are based on the same fundamental numbers, on the same fundamental constants? So you have the same multiples, the same lengths of time that repeat themselves over and over again. You find them in the Maya calendar, you find them in Babylonian chronologies, even in ancient Hindu cosmologies, in Chinese mythology. And these are always numbers that appear to be correlated to the cycle of precession, the so-called precession of the equinoxes, or other great celestial and cosmic cycles that seem to have inspired these ancient cosmologies.
Now, there's one thing in the beginning of the book that I think is more inferred than anything else, and I want to run this past you, Marco, and see if I'm close on the theory. And that is this. Throughout these different civilizations that we're talking about, they could be, whether it's a Sumerian, whether it's Egyptian, whether it be Atlantean. It seems like through all these different civilizations, the idea is that the gods, we'll call them that for lack of a better term, take some sort of human form, bring knowledge down from that human form or into that human form, and then establish technology from there in these different civilizations with a somewhat mixing somewhat of the magical with technological in a numerical system in that. Is that correct?
Yes, and this is truly a fundamental belief that you find at the core of pretty much all religious systems and mythical traditions around the world, which is the idea of the incarnation or the materialization of a divine principle. Again, if you think of Christian cosmology, that's what you find. It's the idea of the incarnation of Jesus, if you are a believer. But you find very similar concepts also in Hindu mythology and in Buddhism, for instance, and more importantly, also in what they call the Western esoteric tradition. There is this idea that thousands and thousands of years ago, at the peak of the Golden Age, some divine beings, again, you can define them however you want. If you prefer to use a more scientific terminology, you could call them multidimensional beings rather than spiritual beings. But there is this idea that these entities incarnated and took physical bodies, they manifested on Earth probably tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years ago, and that's what triggered the process of human evolution and the birth and development of civilization. So that's why I say this is a view which is almost antithetical to that of modern science, modern evolutionary theory, because we're almost constantly thinking about this progression. So we tended to see the process of evolution that leads us towards the future. We see progress in the future, but that's not the way ancient civilization, ancient cosmology is saw the world. They actually saw quite the opposite. They believe that humanity started in an almost divine state, and then through a process of decadence, we reached the present stage. And that's the reason why, for instance, if we look at Hindu cosmology, we actually live at the bottom of the cycle, in the Kali Yuga, the Iron Age. And so we went through different world ages, previous cycles that led us to where we are. So that our civilization is not truly the peak of human culture and achievement. If you want, if you believe in some of these cosmology, we're actually at the bottom of the cycle. And we have got there after thousands of years of decadence from an original divine state, which is truly the core of Plato's story of Atlantis, which we'll discuss in a moment.
Okay. Well, I was going to say, if you would say, at this age, if we're, and I truly do believe we're at the bottom of this age. I mean, if you were going to be at the bottom of any age, staring into a phone rather than looking up at the stars and you know, eschewing the divine, and rather, you know, being completely engrossed with the physical, I would think we're as far away from. And this is, you know, this isn't an opinion, it's fact. I mean, you look around, we're not in touch with spirituality hardly at all. And it seems like we're searching for that answer more than anything now. It seems like, if anything, we're firmly in that bottom part of that age. So with that being said, how do you get back to the beginning of that divine age? How does that cycle through, or how does that transition happen?
Yes. So and that's where a number of myths, including that of Plato's Atlantis, come into the picture. Because of the Atlantis, and that might be a conventional name, right? But that's truly the name that in the esoteric tradition in Plato's account is associated to the civilization of the previous cycle of the last Golden Age. And so if you read Plato's account, again, you find the same idea of the incarnation and manifestation on the terrestrial plane of some spiritual divine beings. And then you have this wonderful civilization, this mighty empire of Atlantis, the greatest and mightiest civilization that the world had ever seen, however, inevitably falls into decadence as the divine element, and that's almost word by word what Plato says, the divine element became diluted. So there was a process of materialization in a way. These original spiritual and almost divine civilization decayed and fell into materialism, and that's what brought about the decadence and eventually the fall of Atlantis. So it's a process of degeneration, of degradation, if you want, that in some traditions is just an inevitable cyclical though, but might also be based on certain cosmic cycles, hence the connection with the precession of the equinoxes. There is almost the idea that certain cosmic influences are what truly rules this cycle and causes the shift from one age to another, and so that we go from a golden age to a silver age, bronze age, iron age, and so on, and then the cycle starts over again. So it's almost as if this whole process of the like birth and then like the decadence and fall of civilization and then eventually the rebirth of civilization is ruled in a way by some great cosmic principle that is quite literally written in the stars.
I was just going to say it's almost like it's written in the stars, like we're going through star cycles and and it's almost dictated there, and we follow along much like a tide in the moon.
Exactly. And the ancients believe, and if you actually look at many of these ancient chronologies and cosmology, what you find is numbers that are very closely related to the cycle of the precession of the equinoxes. Now, for those of you who may not be familiar with this concept, it's a very long cycle. It's believed to last between around 25,920 years, but that's probably just an approximation. Now, the scientific explanation for these movement or cycle of precession is basically a wobble in the Earth's axis, as the Earth's axis, as you know, does not spin perfectly perpendicular. It's actually tilted around 23 degrees. It also wobbles around the central axis, which causes over time the Earth to face a different constellation during the equinoxes. That's the reason why it's called the precession of the equinoxes, because over very long periods of time, an observer based on Earth would almost observe the sun rising at the equinox in a different constellation. That's why we talk about cosmological ages. There is this idea that we currently live at the end of the age of Pisces. We're going to soon transition the age of Aquarius. This is all terminology related to the precession of the equinoxes. Now, if this were just a little wobble in the Earth's axis, clearly there is no reason to believe this would have any effect on the cycles of civilization or the development of life on Earth. So that's why many ancient cosmologies actually give a very different explanation for precession, which is not based on just a simple wobble in the Earth's axis, but is actually based on the idea that the Earth and the solar system itself may be part of of a binary star system and the interplay, the gravitational interplay within this binary star system is what truly causes the effects that we associate with precession. There's actually a wonderful book by Walter Crattenden, which is called Lost Star of Myth and Time, that explores this concept in great depth. But it's truly a very ancient concept because we find it in Hindu cosmology, mm-hmm. we find numerous myths in ancient Egypt and many other cultures around the world that that provide this kind of explanation.
So I guess I double back to something we said earlier in the program, and that is, it's interesting how each one of these cultures from South America to Africa, to the mid-Atlantic, to all the way over to China, into Asia, how they all have similar forms of this cosmology, of mm-hmm. math, of language, of even advanced technology. Because at this time, all of these regions of the world are using advanced technology to build beautiful monuments, amazing architecture, that we fall into a period, and we'll get into this as well a little bit later in the program, where we regress after this amazing age, that we can't seem to keep up with. We go from being able to use amazing technology and build these amazing things to using stone tools and
but we start over again like children. Exactly what Plato says.
I guess that my point being here, the roundabout point being here, is how is that a people in South America are able to, and I'm going to use the example of pyramids here, Marco. Mm-hmm. You have the pyramids of Giza in Egypt. You have pyramids in South America, and they're amazingly similar, mm-hmm. just different cultures. How is it that far away?
There are really three different explanations for the similarities across ancient cultures. You've mentioned already a number of those. The first one, which is the one that you hear most frequently in mainstream science and archaeology, is that these were just independent developments, meaning that all these civilizations somehow came up to the same conclusions, to the same architectural forms, to having the same myths, the same traditions independently of each other. Mm-hmm. But I think that this is largely untenable when you look at the details of these traditions, of these legacy that all these civilizations carry. These cannot have originated independently. I think the similarities go much beyond just like the surface. I think they include a very deep analogies, the use of very similar images or symbols to describe the same things. So we're talking about things that cannot have originated independently, which brings us to the other two possible hypotheses. So the second one is that there was at some point some transoceanic contact, meaning that maybe ancient Egyptian or Phoenician sailors sailed to South America and therefore implanted some of their culture and civilization into these lands, or vice versa, mm-hmm. As well. That's also a possibility. The problem with this idea is that when you look, for instance, at the Great Pyramid Age in Egypt, even if we stick to mainstream archaeology and like conventional chronologies, we're talking about a time around 3000 BC, whereas in the case of the Maya pyramids, the real flourishing of Maya civilization in the classic period was only between, let's say, almost 200 600 BC to 700 AD. So we're talking about a time over 2,500, almost 3,000 years after the beginning of the Pyramid Age in Egypt. And if we go to Cambodia, for instance, we look at Angkor, the mountain temples of Angkor. These are, by all definitions, medieval monuments. They were built between the 9th and the 13th century AD. So again, thousands of years later. So it doesn't really make sense to assume that this civilization ever interacted. Just that the time frame is different. I do believe, by the way, that there might have been contacts, even transoceanic contacts, but I don't think these would have been influential enough as to drive the type of analogies and similarities that we find among ancient cultures, which really leaves us with the last hypothesis, the last possibility, which is that all these civilizations had a common ancestor of very remote, of prehistoric antiquity, that at some point in remote antiquity disseminated its culture and civilization around the world, in a way pollinating all these different cultures, so that when you see the emergence of similar myths, similar traditions, similar even architectural forms, like the concept of the pyramid, that's because this was based on a common legacy inherited from these much older civilization that I do believe was a global civilization at some point.
Okay. Let's run it back a little bit, and we're going to take our break here in a little bit, but I want to start off by kind of mapping out a little bit of Atlantis before we, and a little bit of its beginnings. Now, Plato was one who was, it seemed, wanting to get the story of Atlantis out there, and mm-hmm. wanting to not forget the rich history of Atlantis. If it weren't for Plato, I think the king's list of Atlantis, the history of Atlantis, the rich stories of Atlantis would have been lost to all time. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the interesting thing is that Plato never claimed he invented the story of Atlantis. He actually says explicitly that he picked up the story from his grandfather, Solon, who in turn had learned it from the priests of Egypt. So that the origin of the story itself is Egyptian, according to Plato. Now, this is a very interesting because if we go to Egypt, then we find very similar myths. For instance, in the so-called Edfu building texts, which are a set of hieroglyphic texts that cover the walls of the temple of Edfu in Upper Egypt, that tell a story that is almost identical to that of Plato's Atlantis, basically the story of a mighty civilization of a lost golden age that ended in cataclysm and of how the survivors then spread civilization throughout the world. Now, another interesting aspect of Plato's story that a few people, I think, are aware of is that in Plato's account, Atlantis or the Atlanteans are not the heroes of the story. They're almost the villains of the story, in a way, because you have to think of this mighty civilization. That's how Plato describes it. At some point, became so corrupted, they fell so deeply into materialism that they wanted to subdue the entire world. They waged a war of conquest to subdue all the peoples on this side of the Atlantic Ocean, which in the case of Plato basically included Europe and Africa and Asia. And the only force that was able to oppose the Atlanteans was the Athenians. So this prehistoric Athens is really the hero of Plato's story. That's the only force that was able to resist the Atlantean invasion. And then we all know how Plato's account ends with a council of the gods that deliberates that Atlantis has to be destroyed because it's become a threat to humanity, and that's how Atlantis is sunk into the depths of the ocean. But this is something that Plato does not actually state, because Plato's account is fragmented. It stops just before he describes the destruction, the sinking of Atlantis.
Now, I'll ask this question carefully, Marco, in that, why is Plato's story of Atlantis not a cautionary tale as to a civilization not getting too big for its britches, so to speak, and not a historical account of a civilization?
Well, I would say it is both. We need to keep in mind that Plato was first and foremost a philosopher. So he was not a historian. So he uses a historical account, the story of Atlantis that he gathered from Solon and from Egyptian sources. But then he builds on that and he uses it as the basis of what is essentially a philosophical or almost a moralistic tale about how even the most splendid civilization, the mightiest civilization that the world had ever seen, is not immune to corruption and decadence and would eventually meet its end, just like Atlantis.
Okay. So we're gathering information about Atlantis and what exactly its society is like. And I'll tell you what, we'll take our break right here. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about what exactly Atlantis was, what kind of kingdom it was, what was involved in the kingdom of Atlantis, and how it started out. It didn't start out to be an evil society that eventually had to be destroyed. In fact, it was a kingdom of technological wonders and did have some mighty modern day amenities. And we'll talk about that when we come back. The book is The Empires of Atlantis, The Origins of Ancient Civilizations and Mystery Traditions Throughout the Ages. The author is our guest today, Marco M. Vigato. And we'll talk more about The Empires of Atlantis when we come back here on the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio. Welcome back to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio. I'm Tim Dennis, your host. Our guest is Marco Vigato, who is the author of the book, The Empires of Atlantis, The Origins of Ancient Civilizations and Mystery Traditions Throughout the Ages. And before we went to break, Marco, we were talking a little bit about the actual kingdom of Atlantis and what we could find if we went to Atlantis back in its heyday, so to speak. If we were to, at the beginning of Atlantis's creation, if we were to walk in at the first age of Atlantis, the first Atlantean period, what would we find there? What exactly was Atlantis's makeup at that time that we know of historically?
Right. So, and again, you touched on a very important point when you speak about different ages or different periods in Atlantean history, and that's the reason why the book is called The Empires of Atlantis, because we have to think of these civilizations not just a point-in-time episode, but as a culture that covered tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of years. So throughout the course of Atlantean history, this civilization evolved and changed quite dramatically. Now, if we go back to the very beginnings of Atlantean civilization, then the evidence from let's say the hard sciences of archaeology, of geology, is quite limited, because we're talking about a time period over several tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of years ago. And so that's why we need to complement the evidence from various fields of science with the testimony of the esoteric tradition, which provides a wealth of information on Atlantis and other lost civilizations that might have existed at the time. So we can base our account on two sources, or two types of sources, essentially. One is the esoteric tradition, the other one is the testimony of various historical and mythical accounts, like that of Plato's Atlantis, and other similar accounts that we found throughout the world, which allow us, in a way, to reconstruct and to create a picture of what Atlantean civilization would have looked like in the first period. Now, one important aspect is that by most accounts, Atlantean civilization was a scientifically advanced society, although not necessarily a technologically advanced society. Now, I think this is a very important point, because very often, particularly in, let's say, some of the most recent speculation on Atlantis, it tends to be depicted as these very high-tech ancient civilization. However, this is not what we find necessarily in the ancient depictions or in the testimony of the esoteric tradition. Mm-hmm. This is clearly described as a scientifically advanced civilization, meaning that they possessed an advanced science, but it is also suggested that in a way they were able to control certain universal forces, certain energies in a much more direct way. So if we go, for instance, to the writings of the Theosophists of Rudolf Steiner, they talk about the Atlanteans' mastery of the life force as what really allowed the Atlanteans to perform incredible feats of science, of art, engineering, really like mastering all these many different sciences and disciplines, and having almost a direct understanding, a direct intuition and control of natural forces, which did not necessarily require a mechanical technology. There's actually evidence that this kind of mechanical technology only developed much later, as some of the original more spiritual faculties of the early Atlanteans disappeared or became numbed through a process of materialization.
So, Marco, when you say that they could perform feats of art and engineering, are you talking something similar to telekinesis or anti-gravity? Or what is it that they used in order to create these feats of extreme physical skill without necessarily having to use physical skill?
Well, it's a question that we can only answer based on the testimony of the esoteric tradition. And there we find descriptions, for instance, of flying machines, as you say. This idea that the Atlanteans, by mastering, by controlling this life force, even using to some extent some mechanical devices, they could create these wonderful inventions. There is the idea as well that they could project like their thought into matter. What do we call probably like almost supernatural powers in a certain way? What that involved was basically a direct ability of the mind to influence matter. I think that's what we find in the esoteric tradition, and that's what is generally attributed to the first Atlantean period.
So it's basically projecting this life force without expending it to the point where they're without it. It would be a regenerating life force?
Well, I think that's a very difficult question to answer. There is the idea that these control or this mastery of the life force was something innate in the Atlanteans that came from their spiritual origins, essentially, again, going back to the idea that tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years ago, some spiritual being or multidimensional beings incarnated on this plane of existence in the material world. These are entities also possessed faculties that may not have been limited by just our three-dimensional or four-dimensional reality. And that's how they could achieve direct control over space and time and a direct influence of mind over matter. At least that's what is suggested by numerous traditions from around the world and by the Western esoteric tradition.
Now, going through the book, would it be safe to say that the Atlanteans in this age are not necessarily what we would consider humans of our Homo sapien type humans? Were they a more evolved human?
Well, that's, again, I think a very interesting question, because there is no doubt that these Atlanteans were real flesh and bones individuals, even though their souls, if you want, might have been highly evolved, even though they were a pretty highly spiritual civilization, at least in the early stages of their cultural development. But at the same time, there is no doubt, if you read Plato's account, if you read the accounts in the esoteric tradition, that these were flesh and bones individuals. Now, the question is, did they belong to the same human species as we do? And the answer to this question is actually quite complex. It's probably a no, in the sense that, and this is what I also suggest in the book, that this Atlantean civilization was not just a civilization, but it was actually a separate human species, almost a different branch of human evolution. So we have this model right now that most modern humans or anatomical modern humans evolved somewhere in East Africa over 200,000 years ago. But this does not exclude the possibility of a parallel evolution of a different human species or multiple human species even in different parts of the world. And this is what we are seeing, for instance, right now with the discovery of the Denisovans in Central Asia. So that we're transitioning, I think, towards a model of human evolution that postulates and assumes the existence at the same time of multiple human species, where we had Neanderthals, Denisovans, so what we call anatomical modern humans, and probably other human species as well, of which we know very little. And I do believe that these early Atlanteans represented a separate human species, like a different branch of the human family, that over the course of thousands of years, then also mixed with other hominin species to give rise to modern humans, to us, basically.
And there's one thing I want to point out about that. I thought maybe we would get to that a little bit later in the program, but let's address it now, because there is a point in history, and we'll address it a little bit later in the program as well, but I want to bring up Cro-Magnons. Mm-hmm. And I'm tying this up in one big bow eventually towards the end of the program, and I'll hit that spot when we hit it. But there's something in your book that alludes to Atlanteans potentially mating with, is it Neanderthals? Mm-hmm. Is that what it is?
Yes, or other hominins, at mm-hmm. least could have been Neanderthals, could have been Homo erectus. Now, something very fascinating when you think about Cro-Magnon. So for those of you who may not be familiar with the terminology, Cro-Magnon is another definition of anatomically modern humans. It's particularly used to designate the first anatomically modern humans that appeared in the European continent around 45,000 years ago. Now, what is interesting about Cro-Magnon men is that it possessed a set of characteristics and traits that set it apart from all other hominin species and from Neanderthal men in particular. They were, to begin with, much taller, much more robust. They had a much larger skull and therefore probably were also more intelligent. They were the first to develop a sophisticated forms of art, as we find in the painted caves in Ardèche and in the south of France. And what is curious about Cro-Magnon man is that it appears almost suddenly, without any direct link, really, between the still relatively primitive Neanderthal and Homo erectus or Homo heidelbergensis, like all these different hominin species that existed before Cro-Magnon in the European continent, with these already like very sophisticated, very well developed culture and civilization. And it looks like Cro-Magnon men appear from the West, which again I find fascinating in connection with the story of Atlantis, or this idea of a separate human evolution on Atlantis, in these now sunken mid-Atlantic landmass, and from there then moved into Europe, into Africa, and Asia. And you have different waves of what are called Cro-Magnon invasions in Europe, which are given different names by scientists, mostly associated with the type of stone technology that's called lithic industry that they employed. But invariably, these Cro-Magnon invasions, they start in the West and then moved eastwards, as if to suggest a migration from the Atlantic or from some now lost or sunken mid-Atlantic landmass. Now, if we also look then at the genome, at the DNA these Cro-Magnon, you find a number of very interesting things. First of all, it looks like Cro-Magnon was essentially a hybrid, which is what it suggests in the book, between earlier human forms or earlier hominin species, which might have included Neanderthal, Homo erectus, Homo heidelbergensis, and a still unidentified human ancestor, which I do believe was pretty originary of this mid-Atlantic continent, and provided, therefore, the missing link, if you want, between earlier hominins and fully modern humans. Now, some of the genetic traces as well of these can be found in the worldwide diffusion of haplogroup X and the Rh negative blood factor. When we talk about haplogroup X, this is a haplogroup, so a set of genetic characteristics of alleles, as they're called, on the mitochondrial DNA. What is curious about that is that it's only transmitted on a matrilinear line, meaning from the mother, and it is found in very high concentrations in Western Europe, including the European Atlantic seaboard. Also, curiously, in some parts of the Middle East, mostly in Lebanon, and then it surfaces with a very significant prevalence in Eastern and North America. Now, this is very curious, right? Like, because you have an almost direct genetic connection between populations that were separated by an entire ocean, literally, by thousands of miles, and still they carry the same DNA, the same genetic footprint. The other genetic trait is the Rh negative blood factor, which is still largely a mystery for geneticists how exactly it originated, but it is found with a very high frequency, pretty much among in the same areas where we also find a very high prevalence of haplogroup X, as if to suggest that these genetic traits were brought there by the same people that at some point colonized both Western Europe and some parts of the Middle East and the American continent as well.
Exactly. So you're hitting on all the points here that I was wanting to make in this, and that you've I think you're going to know where I'm going with this, Marco, when I state this. You've stated that the Atlanteans had developed some sort of airship. You've pointed out the Rh negative trait in the blood. There's two things that are associated with those things, and I think you know where I'm going, my friend, when I say this. Do you, when I say that?
No, I will let you say that.
Aliens. And alien human hybrids. Now follow me when I say this. A lot of people who claim that they are alien human hybrids or that they have had something to do with aliens automatically claim that they have an Rh negative blood type. Which is interesting because, as you've pointed out, there could be a very easy explanation to it.
Yeah, I don't believe that. I actually do not believe in anything like ancient aliens. I do believe that all these seemingly unexplained structures or works of engineering for the ancient past were probably created with the use of advanced technology, or at least technology that we do not understand. But I do believe that the origin of that technology was essentially terrestrial. Also, when we talk about Atlantean civilization, I'm always talking about a human culture, a terrestrial culture, even though that might have been a different human space or a different branch in the human evolutionary tree, but I definitely do not believe in, let's say, like direct extraterrestrial visitation or intervention. Now, that does not exclude the possibility, which again is suggested by the esoteric tradition, that at some point in the remote past, some spiritual entities or multidimensional beings took earthly manifestation. They took physical bodies on Earth. But I think there we're entering more in the field of the spiritual and metaphysical. We're not really talking about flesh and bones entities that descend on their airships or flying saucers or anything like that.
Well, if I can just throw you off for just a second here, and then we'll get back on track. And I'm not trying to sway you in any way, Marco, so don't think I am. But I'm just pointing out that in those two points, you may have debunked the alien theory. But I will come back with this. I'm playing devil's advocate, if you will, here, Marco. In this, I would bring up this. The examples of what are deemed as alien craft in the Bible, okay? The examples of alien craft in Renaissance paintings and cave paintings, which go back to, again, we're talking about Neanderthal examples of cave paintings that point out craft, which could have been those Atlantean craft, don't get me wrong. But that if there were flying craft at that time, it could be Neanderthals seeing Atlantean craft and painting them. You know, they are a literal people. They're probably painting or making it, not painting, but making a sketch of a craft that they're seeing in the air. You know, for years that's been pointed out by ufologists as, well, that's got to be solid proof of an extraterrestrial presence. I guess I would comment to you or question to you, if you see all this stuff from ufology corners, you know, lights in the sky, things like that. Would you say that that is, would you say that that would, you would tend to slant more alien, or do you think that we still have Atlanteans and that Atlantean culture still around to this day?
Yeah, no, I think particularly the second possibility suggests, I think it's a very intriguing one. There might be some remnants, at least of these very advanced ancient civilizations that still exists around us, and like somehow has managed to survive and to continue. Now, when you talk about evidence, like the pictorial evidence you mentioned of ancient flying craft, but we can add here also many ancient accounts, as we find, for instance, in the Hindu epics, in the Mahabharata, in the Ramayana, there are numerous accounts of flying machines, seemingly technologically advanced weapons. They're clearly incompatible with the picture of civilization, of Indian civilization that we had at the time these works were composed, these texts were written. But what I find interesting is that in all these cases, what is described, I think, is a clearly human technology. Like the people that drive these crafts are human, like clearly very advanced humans, but they're always talking about flesh and bones individuals. Even though when we look at the Bible, and it's interesting you mentioned that, this idea of flying crafts in the Bible, and there are a number of examples in the Book of Enoch, for instance, there are numerous descriptions of these flying crafts, but then mm-hmm. the people that are described there as maneuvering these crafts, be it the watchers, the fallen angels, however you want to call them, according to biblical terminology, they're described as surprisingly human or human-like. Now, an interesting suggestion that is made in the Book of Enoch is that these, and they would call them very advanced humans, at some point they also mixed with other cultures, like more primitive cultures that existed on Earth at the time. They produced an offspring which are called the Nephilim in biblical mythology, which to me is evidence enough to suggest that the difference or the genetic distance between these two species was probably not too big. Of course, we're talking about one very advanced civilization, another one much more primitive. We're talking about what were possibly two separate or distinct human species, but we're still talking about human species, because otherwise all of these genetic admixture or these interbreeding would not have been possible. And also in the scientific literature, there are many examples now that have been positively identified of hybridization between Neanderthal, Denisovans, and anatomically modern humans. So I don't find it implausible to think that if separate human species developed on a now sunken mid-Atlantic landmass like Atlantis, that people from that lineage also mixed with other hominin species, creating hybrids and possibly giving rise to modern humans.
Okay. We had hinted towards the modern day, and I'm going to switch gears a little bit here. The modern, I shouldn't say modern day, but for modern for that day, amenities that they had in Atlantis. Do you just want to briefly go over what those were and what they had in Atlantis during that time, during that golden age?
Well, when Plato describes Atlantis, he talks about a very sophisticated civilization. It was essentially a maritime civilization that ruled over the seas. Now, Plato's description of the capital city of Atlantis is certainly magnificent. He describes this enormous city surrounded by canals stretching for hundreds of miles to a point that Plato says that it's almost impossible to believe that a work of that magnitude could have been artificial, just because the scale of these engineering works that Plato attributes to the Atlanteans were so enormous, so stupendous, as to be almost unbelievable. So we truly have to imagine a civilization that was clearly very advanced in the arts of navigation with a maritime culture, but also possessed very sophisticated architecture and engineering, of which we clearly find a trace in many of the megalithic structures that still survive around the world, in Egypt, in the Middle East, in Peru, that may have been influenced by Atlantean architectural techniques. Now, if we also go through some of the texts, and I mentioned already some of the Hindu epics, even the biblical narrative, there is a suggestion that the Atlanteans also possessed an advanced form of technology that might have included aerial crafts, as well as weapons that would probably describe in today's terms as weapons of mass destruction, which they also employed against other Atlantean factions, against more primitive humans in over the course of various wars that are described in these texts.
Interesting. Well, you mentioned war and you mentioned weapons of mass destruction. Now, there was a war between the children of the Law of One and the sons of, is it Belial?
Belial.
Yes. Okay. So describe to us, and that's in the first Atlantean period. Describe to us what exactly that war was and what they were fighting over.
So we find many references to this war, most famously and most recently in the readings of Edgar Casey. But the Casey is by no means the only source on these were basically the concept or the idea behind is that at the end of the first Atlantean period, you would have found two different factions. So one called the Children of the Law of One, to use Casey's terminology. They were still followers of the original spiritual principles of Atlantean civilization. Then on the other hand, you had the sons of Belial that were already deeply materialistic. They employed technology and they employed science, including the life force, for purposes of world domination. So these are triggered, according to the esoteric tradition, a conflict between these two factions, which is what brought about the first Atlantean cataclysm, the first fall of Atlantis, which, according to the chronologies that I derive in the book, occurred around 35,000 years BC. So that was the first Atlantean cataclysm that caused an initial sinking of the islands of Atlantis, initial fragmentation of the Atlantean landmass. It also caused a massive exodus, almost a diaspora of people, from Atlantis towards the land on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean.
So at this point, you've had the beginnings of a sinking. Is this thing underwater, or is it maintaining itself? What happens when this first sinking starts to take place?
Yes. So the idea here is that when I think about the sinking of Atlantis, this was not a point in time episode. So that probably spanned many thousands, maybe even millions of years. We have to now talk a little bit more about the geology of Atlantis. Now, by most accounts, Atlantis was a landmass in the mid-Atlantic Ocean that would have been located more or less in the same location of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, which is this huge submarine mountain chain that stretches almost from pole to pole. Now, what is incredible about the Mid-Atlantic Ridge is that even though it's mostly underwater, with the exception of a few islands, there are really just the mountaintops of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, like the Azores, that emerge above water. But if you were to imagine the Mid-Atlantic region without the ocean, there would be a mountain chain as long as the combined Rocky Mountains and the Andes of South America, with heights comparable to the Himalayas. So there would be a truly massive mountain chain, probably the largest and greatest mountain chain in the world. And now it's entirely or almost entirely submerged. So now, the process that led to the sinking of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge was at times a gradual process, at times a catastrophic one. There is evidence that the Mid-Atlantic Ridge sunk in places by as many as 2,000 or 3,000 meters within the span of just a couple of centuries, which in geological terms is nothing. It's just a heartbeat or the blink of an eye. These were really cataclysmic episodes. One of these cataclysmic episodes was what led to the initial sinking and fragmentation of Atlantis. But then there were more, and this is also what I discuss in the book. There were at least three major episodes of sinking of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, one just around 35,000 years BC, which coincides with the first Atlantean cataclysm. There was a second major sinking of land in the North Atlantic, particularly around 11,000 years BC or 13,000 years ago, which is the same time as what is now known as the Younger Dryas Cataclysm, when scientists believe a massive fragmenting comet impacted our planet, causing worldwide devastation. And then there was a third major episode of sinking at the time of the European Bronze Age, so between 3000 BC and 1200 BC, which is what caused the famous Sea People invasions, which was really the last wave of migration from Atlantis towards the Atlantic coasts of Europe and America.
Now, before the war, there's a migration of sorts of some of the Children of the Law of One, correct? Mm-hmm. And they, I believe you, if I remember right, they started to migrate towards Africa. Is that correct? Towards Egypt?
Yes, and here again we go back to the teachings of the esoteric tradition, in particular the teachings of Theosophy, this great movement that developed in the 19th and the early 20th century, which claimed to have access to all this wealth of information of esoteric sources. And what these documents describe is, as you say, a migration from Atlantis, first into Africa and then into Asia. So there is the suggestion here that the children of the Law of One that represented the most spiritual element of Atlantean civilization decided to leave Atlantis before the cataclysm that would lead to its first major sinking, or to escape the catastrophe, and in order to rebuild a new civilization in Central Asia. So in order to do that, they had to migrate first through Africa, where they established a number of colonies in Africa, and then through the Middle East, until they finally settled in Central Asia, in a region that, according to Theosophy, can be identified with what is nowadays a desert, the Gobi Desert. But back then, we're talking about time over 20,000 years ago, was still a large inland sea with an island in the center. And that's on that island, which is called the White Island in the esoteric tradition, that these Atlantean refugees establish a new center of civilization after the fall of the first Atlantean empire.
Okay, and then in the book you mentioned something about the rise of a sea people, or the sea people. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit how they figure into this whole equation.
Well, this idea of the sea people really connects with the sinking of Atlantis, which I was referring to before, as to the fact that the sinking of Atlantis was not just a single episode, but it continued in more or less cataclysmic forms over thousands, if not tens of thousands of years. And so at every major time of sinking or subsidence in the mid-Atlantic region that triggered massive migrations of people from the islands of Atlantis, from this mid-Atlantic landmass towards the coast of Europe and of North and South America. So when you're talking about the sea peoples, there are actually multiple waves of sea people's invasion. The most recent ones, they have been recorded in texts from Egypt, from Greece, from the Near East. We have two, really, one around 3000 BC, another one around 1200 BC. The earliest of the two in 3000 BC was what really triggered, on the one hand, the flourishing of the European megalithic culture. So you have, at that time, a surge of construction on the European Atlantic seaboard, on the Atlantic coast of France, on the British Isles, in Ireland, even as far south as the south of Spain and North Africa, where you find all these great megalithic monuments, passage tombs, dolmens, that share a number of common characteristics, beginning from the use of the same units of measurements, the megalithic yard, a certain system of proportion that clearly suggested a same culture was responsible for the construction, for the creation of these monuments. And clearly this culture came from the West. So what I suggest is that these megalithic culture actually originated on Atlantis, and it was the sinking of a part of the Atlantic, of this mid-Atlantic continent, of the Atlantean landmass, that triggered these migration of people. Now you have a second wave of sea people invasions, which is probably the most famous one, around 1200 BC, which is the time when Egyptian sources record the arrival of these sea peoples from the West. What is interesting about many of these documents and Egyptian sources, and they quote from a number of them, from a number of these inscriptions, like the ones from the Temple of Medinet Habu in Egypt, is that they talk about these massive migration of people that originated from a land located somewhere in the open Atlantic Ocean, in the northern Atlantic Ocean, which sunk as a consequence of what sounds like, what looks like, could have been a cometary impact or another cosmic impact of a large celestial body that caused the sinking of these landmass and a massive outflow or migration of peoples that first reached the coasts of Europe and North Africa, but some of which also penetrated much farther into the Mediterranean, eventually reaching Egypt and attempting a conquest of Egypt.
I wonder, Marco, and I want to get back to the sinking of Atlantis here. If I know it's way too deep by this point, if we were to be able to pinpoint it in the ocean, it's way too deep for any of us to try and get down there. I mean, obviously, we'd be crushed to death to try and get down there and find ruins for ourselves. But we do have technology now where we can build technology where we could get down there if we could find it and get some of those ruins or remains and try to bring it back up. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
Well, I do believe so. In my opinion, the most likely location, if we were to pinpoint at least the location of Plato's Atlantis, which is really the last remnant or the last island of Atlantis, would probably have been located in the region of the Azores Plateau, which is a very large plateau around 600 by 400 kilometers, which is almost flat, that shows evidence of a sudden and cataclysmic sinking. Now, one question, you're right. I think that with the technology that we have today, we could probably scan that area with sonar, like side scan sonar, and like try to see if there is anything recognizable. But the reality is that we'll probably find very little. It's not only because of the extreme depth, but you have to think that the geological processes that caused the sinking of Atlantis would have almost obliterated every trace of civilization and culture. You have to imagine the strongest earthquake or something, an order of magnitude stronger than even the strongest earthquakes ever recorded. At a time, you have to imagine volcanic eruptions. So any sort of remnants would have probably been reduced to dust by earthquakes and volcanic eruptions long before it even became submerged. And then at that depth, just with the accumulation of sediments, it would be buried under tens, even hundreds of meters of sediments on the seafloor. It's also a very active geological fault, so there is constant ejection of magma from the Atlantic seafloor in that region, which would have almost entirely obliterated any remnants. Now, I'm not saying that it's entirely impossible that anything would have survived. I think something might have survived, but it will be a truly enormous task to try to identify these remnants. I think we have much better chances if we look at those portions of the Azores Plateau that are closer to surface, even the Azores Islands themselves, which were truly just the summits of these huge sunken mountains. And also in those lands, they were probably colonized by Atlanteans at the time. And this is where I think we are far more likely to find evidence and remnants of Atlantean civilization.
I was going to say, with all the sediment that's probably down there, and much like you pointed out, with the underground fault lines and everything, volcanoes, what would you hope they could, or what would you wish they could come up with if you could find, let's say, one or two things that might survive all that destruction?
Well, I think stone structures would probably, or at least have shown from an ability to withstand very long periods of time, particularly if they were built of durable stones like granite, like basalt, for instance. This could very well withstand thousands of years of erosion, assuming they were not buried in sediments or like volcanic eruptions, for instance. So stone structure, some evidence of stonework might be among what could be found. And it will be much more difficult to find any remnants of, let's say, like metal objects. Anything like that would erode pretty quickly, particularly at those depths. So that's unlikely that anything like that would survive. However, if we were to really find evidence or like positive evidence to support this idea of an advanced civilization, we should probably be looking for something more durable than that, like crystal, for instance. Is something it could have like withstood much better the test of time. And then there is always the question as to whether we would recognize these remnants for what they are, meaning that after tens of thousands of years of erosion, would we even be able to recognize stonework or like an artificially cut stone block, which has been the case, by the way, with many of these submerged sites around the world. And now, just a couple of decades ago, it was announced the discovery of these ruins off the coast of India and the Gulf of Cambay. And now, 20 years later, there is still debate among geologists and archaeologists to whether these are actual ruins or just some curious geological formation. So I think it will be a really difficult to find the positive evidence from the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, particularly at those depths of 3,000, 4,000 meters below sea level. I think our best chances, again, are to look for evidence of Atlantean colonists in other parts of the world, where these records and these constructions might have been preserved.
You're right about that, and it'd be nice if we could find some sort of record or something that. But even then, how would you translate? What would you expect? What language it would be in? I mean,
well, there is the suggestion that throughout all these different cycles of civilization and the different cataclysms that periodically wiped out civilization, because humanity start over again, some records were preserved, which was what allowed civilization to start over again. So there is this idea, for instance, Nader Casey, of some Atlantean halls of records, where all the knowledge and technology of Atlantis was preserved through the cataclysm, so that a future humanity could again access these repositories of knowledge and use the knowledge contained in these time capsules in order to restart civilization. And I do believe there is actually evidence that some of these repositories not only existed, but were actually accessed at some time, at some point in the past, which is what allowed, for instance, for civilization to restart in the aftermath of the Younger Dryas cataclysm after the end of the last ice age. But there might still be other repositories that are still concealed, are still almost like time capsules, so they are still sealed and awaiting discovery. Now, assuming that we will be able to find one of these repositories, it will be a truly monumental task to decipher all these texts, all these documents. But this is a probably at the same time the only and really conclusive evidence they would expect to find of Atlantis or any other truly advanced civilization, finding an intact time capsule from that civilization. Because there is always going to be debate, as we see, for instance, in the case of the Age of the Pyramids, the Age of the Sphinx, all of these great megalithic monuments, between academic archaeologists and historians and what they would call alternative historians. And these debates, I think there are arguments being spent on both sides, but they never reach a conclusion. I think the only really conclusive evidence will be to uncover one of those time capsules where we'll have final positive evidence of this civilization, even though, as you say, it would take three centuries or the work of entire generations to unravel all these documents and even to attempt any translation.
Absolutely. Name of the book is The Empires of Atlantis, The Origins of Ancient Civilizations and Mystery Traditions Throughout the Ages. We have a link to this book in the description of this program. By all means, go to that link, click on that link, and pick up a copy of the book for yourself. We've only scratched the surface, folks. This is chock full of information, and we've, like I said, only scratched the surface as to the different stories of Atlantis and different ancient civilizations in here and how they all correlate with each other. It's actually very fascinating how these different ancient civilizations correlate with each other and how everything sticks together. And Marco, you've done an absolutely fascinating job of putting everything together, my friend. I wish you much, much success with this book.
Well, thank you so much, Dima. It's been a pleasure talking to you and your audience.
Pleasure's all mine. And folks, I want to thank you once again for a great week. And want to remind you that, of course, you know, Super Bowl's coming up this weekend. You're going to be getting together with friends and family. Have a great time. Not too great of a time if you're going to be drinking. Please don't drive. If you're going to be celebrating, be sure to call an Uber, call a cab, call a friend. Be sure to be safe that way. Be kind to one another. I want to thank you for being a valued member of our audience and taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us here on Darkness Radio. We know that your time is valuable each and every week, and I'm glad that you spend it with us here on Darkness Radio. We'll see you next week. We got a good lineup of shows next week, and I'm looking forward to seeing you right back here on Tuesday for more of the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio.